Turn this morning to the Bible's big story, not losing sight of Genesis 12, not losing sight of where we've come from, but here we discovered last Sunday that the good guys had become the bad guys, and yet, despite that, faith was found in remarkable places. In small acts of kindness and love, through those that were considered unimportant, and yet a baby was born and a baby was rescued. And we followed in those early chapters of Exodus, the man that he would become, 40 years as a prince, trained to lead, then 40 years as a shepherd, trained to care. And as I've been reminded throughout the story, it is a God of revelation and a God of rescue. That each time you should be asking the question, not first of all, what is this to do with me, but what does it tell me about God? What is God revealing of himself in it? And in that encounter with Moses, we see a God of revelation who is holy, a God who keeps his promises, and a God who is not ashamed to be the God of his people. He was the God who cares. I have seen, I have heard, I know. He is the God who acts. I have come down. He is among us. He is the God who plans. I will deliver. I will bring them out. I will take you home. He's the God who holds to account. Every tear shed, he knows. Sin matters. Oppression matters. Bullies will be held to account. He's the God who sends and doesn't make mistakes. Moses, I will send you. He is the God who rescues because I have the God who has come to set you free. And in chapters 1 to 13, what God does is that he dismantles the gods of Egypt. He hardens the heart of Pharaoh, and he provides the blood of the lamb over each doorpost of his people. And at last, against all odds, without having to do anything, the people are set free. The only thing they have to do is to trust the blood of the lamb. That's it. God's not looking for performance. He has made a promise towards them. It is the only thing he asks them to do. Let me ask you, what did you do for your salvation? Nothing. God did it all. God did it all. And he's come to set us free. And at last they're free against all odds. And the big story of the Bible is that revelation and rescue where God keeps his promises. And each time you see God's people under threat, the question is, will God keep his promise from this people, from this family, from this nation, to send a rescuer? Every page whispers the name of Jesus. And here's how we finished it from the storybook Bible last week. It said God's people would always remember this great rescue and call it Passover. But an even greater rescue was coming. Many years later, God would do it again. He was going to come down once more to rescue his people. But this time, God was going to set them free forever and ever. And so they are set free. But as we read in our chapter, that now that they are set free, we discover a God who leads. And the question is, where is he going to lead them? Again, the storybook Bible kind of brings it all together by saying this, I will bring you to a new home, a special land God promised them. I will look after you. I am with you. But I imagine that as you read those opening verses of Exodus to discover the places that he went, that doesn't really resonate with you. But would it surprise you to discover that what God does, first of all, he doesn't take the shortest route. He deliberately takes the long route. And this is how he leads. He leads with a pillar of cloud in day and a pillar of fire at night. And as the people are leaving slavery and leaving the past behind them, God leaves them in no doubt as to where they are going and also gives them evidence that he's not going to leave them alone. God is here. God is leading us. And he doesn't lead them the shortest way. And maybe that's because they needed time to unpack and to process everything that they had gone through. But God's delays, God's detours always have a purpose. But here is what happens. It's not just that God takes them the longer way to get to where they're going. He takes them into a cul-de-sac. And he takes them into a dead end. And remember, it's really important. Who's leading them? God is leading them. The cloud and the fire. And they're now into a cul-de-sac. In front of them, they've got a sea. On one side, they've got a desert. And the other side, jagged rocks. And behind them, people that hate them. And the most powerful of enemies who wants them back. And yet, as we read, God's not surprised by all of it. Look at what it says in verse 8 of our passage. It said, "And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly." And the point is this, they're being led into this cul-de-sac, but God is saying, "I'm leading you here into this cul-de-sac for my glory. For my glory. I will harden the heart of Egypt, and I will take you to a place where you think, what's God going to do here? He doesn't care." But God has a purpose for Pharaoh. He's got a purpose for his people. And here is the controlling verse for the whole of the passage. It says this in verse 4, "And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts. An Egyptian shall know that I am the Lord," and they did so. And so God leads them by the long way into a cul-de-sac, where in front of them is a sea. On one side there is a wilderness and a desert, and the other side there are jagged rocks. And behind them, there is a powerful enemy. And the reaction? Entirely predictable. And would we be any different? The disciples in the boat, when the storm comes up, what do they say to Jesus? "Don't you care?" Look at what it says in verse 11. "They said to Moses, 'Is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in wilderness.'" It's a predictable reaction. Fear, doubt, complaining. In fact, the story of the next 40 years of the people of Israel is one of complaint. Do you know what is one of the most repeated commands in the New Testament? Do not grumble. Do not grumble. And yet the story of the Exodus is of the grumbling of God's people against his leading. Was it only Pharaoh who had a heart problem that God had to deal with? So where does panic come from? Panic comes from what we see, what we expect, what we reason, and what we think we can control. And the moment it is beyond our control, what do we give into? Fear, doubt, bitterness, complaint. And the surprising answer to what lies at the heart of it is actually found in Psalm 106 in verse 7. Because there's that bit in us and goes, well, what do you expect them to do? They're in a dead end. It says this in Psalm 106 verse 7, "Our fathers, when they were in Egypt, did not consider your wondrous works. They did not remember the substance of your steadfast love, but rebelled by the sea at the Red Sea." And it's really saying, look, just days before, God dismantled the gods of Egypt, one after another. And it's only taken the first problem for you to doubt, to be afraid, and to complain. God, I will trust you as long as it's green pastures and still waters all the way. But the moment there's a dark valley, we're good as dead, and they despair. "It's all your fault, Moses." And so they blame him. "We wish we had never listened to you," and they're filled with doubt. And here is a perspective that we tried to unpack earlier. Coming alive is one thing. Being set free is one thing. Staying alive is another. Coming alive as a Christian is one thing. Living as if you're alive and set free is another. Imagine a young Christian having come to know Christ and then that first conflict. "I thought you would save me from this, God, not lead me into it." Think of the older Christian. Maybe those that have been protected from some of the soreness and dark valleys of life, suddenly towards the end of life, encountering it and in having real tragedy. But I thought you said you loved me. Any temptation? Fear. The moment it is beyond our control to fix or to manage. Fear. But then it leads to this. Don't you care? Do you remember the first lie in the garden? God doesn't love you. If he loved you, he wouldn't have led you into the cul-de-sac. If he loved you, he wouldn't have let this happen to you. Jesus' response to the disciples in the boat is this. Why are you so afraid? Have you still no faith? And a leader steps up. And he's on his own. There's no mention even of Aaron. He steps up and he says to them, don't be afraid. And there's this remarkable change in Moses. Moses does something that I wish that I could do. He doesn't reply to criticism. He doesn't try and defend himself. And he displays the best evidence of a brilliant leader in that in the time of crisis, he says, look to God. Look at what he says in verse 13. Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation of God, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent. Fear paralyzes. Faith makes you stand firm. And here is what lies at the heart of it. Knowing the promises of God matters. And knowing the character of God changes us. In a few moments at the end of the service, we're going to sing these words. Though Satan should buffet, though trials should come, let this blessed assurance control that Christ hath regarded my helpless estate and has shed his own blood for my soul. God has saved them from the big thing. He set them free from slavery. God has saved you from the big thing. He has sent Jesus, the rescuer, from the cross. Won't he rescue them here from this smaller thing? Didn't they remember the blood of the lamb that was over the lintels? Is this why communion matters so much to us, that it helps us to remember the God who rescues us in the big thing that holds us with the small things? God saved them from Egypt. Why would he abandon them now? God saved you from the God saved us through the cross. So why would he leave you now? So they've got the sea ahead. And they've got the wilderness on one side. And they've got rocks on the other side. And they are hemmed in. And I'm sure you know what that feeling is like where you're hemmed in. But do you know what that feeling is like when you're at the end of your resources? That's the people of Israel. They see no way out. There is no hope. You know what that's like to be hemmed in by your grief, by your fear, by your guilt, by your shame. You know what that's like when you get to that stage where you just go, I don't know what to do. It's no longer within my power. I'm helpless. They look in the front, they look at the left, they look at the right, they look behind them. There's only one direction left. Where can they look? Not in the front, not to the left, not to the right, not to behind. There's only one place to look. Where? Think about the answer in your head. Where can you look? Up. But we don't do that when we're afraid. We cower in. Moses says, look up. What is God up to with Pharaoh? What is God up to towards his people? Where does faith come from? It does not come from looking within. It comes from eyes on him. And all the way through this passage, God begins to reveal himself as the one who defends his people, who surrounds his people, who is with his people. Now, let me ask you, in your time of crisis, where are you looking? If you are a micromanager and you are a fixer, what happens when you can't? What happens when God takes you to the cul-de-sac? I've lost count of the number of times in my life where God has took me to a cul-de-sac and says, you don't have to do anything. So let me ask you, where are you looking? And I'd imagine just now that for some of you, you've not been able to listen because the voices of grief and sorrow and bitterness and anger or whatever it might be are too loud just now. Where do you look? Let me ask you, where do you look for salvation? There's only one way to look. And God comes and he rescues and he quite literally makes their wheels fall off. This insurmountable problem, this irresistible force, this juggernaut of power, and God makes a way. The supernatural God. In small group, we've got somebody who constantly reminds us that God is a supernatural God. What is more amazing here in this passage? Is it his power to do what no one else could do? Or is it his purpose in saving a people who have just moaned at him? What is more amazing, God's power or God's purpose? And you can see the purpose of God. It is to harden the heart of Pharaoh. It is to lead the people into a cul-de-sac. And he gets them into that situation where the only answer is what? It's faith. There are no plans that we can make. It's only faith. God, I can't do anything. You have to rescue. You have to save. Why? Because it's all for his glory. But let me ask you this question. God leads his people through, and then judgment falls upon the people, on the Egyptians. Why do the people of Israel stand on the other side and watch it happen? It's a just judgment. But why was it important for the Israelites to see the Egyptians washed away and overcome? Why this way? I wonder if you're familiar with the story of Jesus' healing of the man who was possessed by the legion of demons at Gennesaret. And the demons argue with them, and Jesus says, and they want to be put into the herd of pigs, and Jesus allows them to go into the herd of pigs, and the herd of pigs rush into the water, and they're all drowned. Why was it important for the man to see that? They were the very things that had held them captive, and now he sees them destroyed. For generations, the Egyptians had held them captive, and now they are no more. There is a song called No Longer a Slave that has this line that says, you split the sea so I could walk through it. My fears are drowned in perfect love. You rescued me so I could stand and say, I am a child of God. I'm no longer a slave to fear. I am a child of God. I'm no longer a slave to fear. Or there's a song, Still Waters, that has this opening line that says, great Aunt Maureen said at 103, write scripture on your heart when you need it, because anxiety hates Psalm 23. So just say to yourself till you believe it, and I'm feeling like I read it, need it right now. No longer a slave. What do you see when you look at the cross? Do you see that you're no longer a slave to your guilt? Do you see that you're no longer a slave to your shame? Do you see you're no longer held captive by bullies, whatever they might be? Do you look at the cross and go, Jesus dealt with them there? To be a Christian is to be set free. To be a Christian is no longer a slave to fear. But some of us want to hold on to it. Some of us identify ourselves by it. The people of Israel need to see the bullies swept away. At the cross, you see your sin swept away. You're no longer a slave to fear. One of my favorite stories is of a mother, and the child had broken the favorite plate in the house. Everyone has a favorite plate, and had broken the favorite plate. And the child said, look what I've done, and they dealt with it, and the mum took the broken pieces and put it in the bin, and they all had a big hug, and everything was okay. The mum came down in the morning and discovered that the child had taken the broken pieces of the plate out of the bin and said, look what I've done. That's a slave to fear. Because when God forgives us, he also forgets. Let me ask you, are you living in freedom from your grief? Or are you holding on to the bitterness? Trust me, what you went through in life is not fair. Are you holding on to your guilt? Somehow the cross is not enough. Or what I did was so bad. Are you in the boat and you see the storms that are cascading around you just now, and like the disciples, you come up to Jesus and you say, Jesus, don't you care? And you're no longer a slave to fear. And here is a challenge. It's not just to hear the words. It's to live like it. Because the people of Israel were brought into that cul-de-sac to learn that not only were they set free from Egypt, they were now to live as if they were set free. There is no one more free than you. Why hold on to the shame and the guilt and the bitterness and the anger and the fear? Will his arm not hold you? Will his power decay? You know what it's like when you're overwhelmed? The only voice that you can hear is the one of grief and sorrow. He brings you to the cul-de-sac to discover that he is sovereign. And the only way forward is faith. The greatest danger to our Christian walk is living self-powered lives. And sometimes we do not discover that we've been living self-powered lives until our latter years, when the things that we relied upon are taken away from us. You're free. Do you believe it? Free from fear. Do you live it? My dad used to always say, he used to do my head in when he said this. He used to say, never let somebody have the power over you to give you a sleepless night. Aye, right. I secretly wanted to go, is that how you do it? You're free. You're free. How do you believe it? And you go, how? Well, here's a brilliant way to remember it. Why did God protect his people? So that the manger would be full. Why did God protect his people? So that the tomb would be empty. And every time you look at the unfolding story of Christmas, what are the people told? Do not be afraid. Let's pray together.